From beanies to carry bags and from shoes to caps, browse our shop now at tntradio.live. Patrick Henningsen and TNT.
All right, folks, we're back. We're back. It's hour number two. I hope you're doing good wherever you are in the world. Just, you know, a little follow-up on our last little rant before the top of the hour news headlines there. One of our listeners in the TNT chat bar has just informed us that this is the avatar known as Free, F-R-E-E, Free says, Patrick, I created a t-shirt that says adult human female, and my online shop at Etsy canceled the shirt for being demeaning or disparaging of people based on gender identity. All I can say is that is so wrong. That is so wrong indeed. What does Greta Thunberg have to say about that?
This is all wrong.
That's right. I agree with Greta. I concur, Greta. It is all wrong. That is so wrong. So you're lucky they didn't cancel your account. They just canceled the shirt. So if you're an adult human female, that's offensive. You can't say that. You definitely can't wear that on a shirt. So you know what this means? When you see stuff like that, that means it's time to double down. That's right. It's time to double down. Everybody needs to go online and create an adult human female t-shirt right now today and go out and wear that around town. I think that's the solution. The solution to, as Mark Zuckerberg says in his own woke way, he did speak some wisdom. He said, the secret to bad speech is more speech. That's right. I couldn't agree more, Mr. Election Rigger and Dropbox King Mark Zuckerberg. I couldn't agree more with Mark on that one. Absolutely. Yeah, just totally mental. Totally mental. Adult human male, adult human female. Yeah, it's going to get ridiculous, isn't it? So, you know, why do we have to rearrange society and build a whole new class of restrooms for what is really 0.00 of a percent of the population? How can they and why should they dictate the agenda for everybody else, right? You know, if we're going to do that, what about the furries? What about the furries or the bronies? You know what bronies are? You know what furries are? That's a marginalized group, people who believe they're animals, who like to wear furry outfits and, you know, run around town and, like, dress like a pony. Or the bronies, which are bros who are into My Pretty Pony, the bronies. Very marginalized group. They've been othered. They've been, you know, abused. You could say people making fun of them, or, you know, grown men who are obsessed with anime. It's a fetish. This is a minority group. These should be protected as well. They should have their own restrooms, and they should. So furries should have all the rights that animals have. All the rights that animals have. And one of the rights that house pets have, and cats and dogs, is they don't have to work. The animals don't have to work, right? The only animals that have to work are mules, donkeys. They have to work. They have to pull carts and things like that, plows in the fields and whatnot. Cows have to work, and sheep, obviously, they have to graze. So they eat grass. That's their job. Okay, but house pets don't do anything. Cats and dogs just sit around and act like they are happy to see you when you come home from work in the afternoon, but really all they want is to get fed, you see. That's a cat and a dog, a domesticated pet. So the furries want to have animal rights so they don't have to work. So if you identify as a furry, you don't actually have to go to work, and that's fair. If we're going to be complete about this, and, you know, if we're serious about diversity, equity, and inclusion, we need to consider the rights of the furries. And yes, there's not many of them. It's 0.004% of the population. It's very, very small, very small number of people. You can find them on Twitch and some on Instagram, mostly on 4chan, 8chan. And Reddit. So, but nonetheless, it would be, you know, insensitive to not include them in these sweeping reforms that we're seeing around, and bronies as well. This is, again, this is a should be a protected class. These are men or bros who are into My Pretty Pony. They like pretty ponies, and to keep them from being, you know, insulted and to people making fun of them and offending them because of their beliefs and their fetish, they should have protected status. They should have their own stripe on the new, you know, the ever expanding rainbow flag. It's now rainbow, trans, and Black Lives Matter. It's all in there now, and you need to get some more stripes in there. And so imagine if you've come from a marginalized group and then you're looking at the flag and you're not seeing a stripe on there that represents you. That's so hurtful. And imagine how offended these minority classes are, the furries, the bronies. There's others too. I've only named a few. Grown men who are obsessed with anime, they're, you know, where are they on the flag? They should have something there. There's all sorts of, you know, marginalized groups. I just think we need to be fair and, you know, include everybody. Give them special rights. You know, it's not fair that your dog and your cat get to sit around and do nothing all day, but a furry, someone who identifies as a cat or a dog, has to go to work every day. That's cruel. That's cruel. We need to put an end to this. We are a compassionate society. You know, we just start acting like it. We can't just marginalize people like this. It's terrible. It says a lot about our culture and our society. We need to overcome these flaws in Western civilization and become more inclusive and more diverse and have equity for everybody. Equity for everybody. So that's all we're going to do on the culture wars today. I hope you enjoyed that. It was a nice little detour. I know you enjoyed it. I did. I feel much better as a person now that I've stood up for these protected classes, and I really feel like this social justice kind of, you know, adrenaline running through my veins right now. I'm so excited. I can feel the love in the chat room too. Show me some love in the chat room. Are you guys up for this new diversity agenda? You know, are you guys up for, are you going to stand up for the furries and the bronies and the rest of them? Come on now. So the litter boxes, I don't think so. I don't want to go that far, folks. Someone said here, Anto in the TNT chat bar says, I wish I had a robot dog. Well, there was a robot dog and his name was Muffet. Muffet. Remember the Battlestar Galactica TV series in the 1980s? It was late 1970s, actually. Boxy was the child character on the Battlestar Galactica. He had a robot dog called Muffet. So Muffet was a really good sort of cyborg-type house pet. But the problem is, folks, you think you're going to be okay with a robot dog or even a house robot, and those are coming pretty soon. Those robots have rights. You think I'm kidding? Now we're getting into some weird territory. There's a whole new area of legal and judicial industry that's going to be for the rights of AI and robot. Because once they claim they're sentient, then they have rights. So you can't abuse your robot. So let's say your robot does something really dumb and, you know, let's say your robot makes some mistake and accidentally kills somebody in your house or something like that, you know, or spills water and someone slips and breaks your aunt slips and breaks her hip, whatever. So, you know, as you own the robot, normally you'd say, you stupid robot, look what you did. You know, this is serious or whatever. And you might sort of, you know, just for the catharsis of it, you know, pick up a baseball bat or something and then whack the robot over the head and say, don't do that again. You know, discipline your robot. Well, you can't do that in the future. The robot has rights. And the robot, if he's sentient, or she, or they, or them, or it, if they're sentient, they could very easily just pick up the phone and call a injury lawyer. And they have rights. So just don't think, all you AI enthusiasts, you haven't thought about this, have you? Oh yeah, there's a whole legal industry now. They're working out the laws as we speak. There's going to be AI courts, robot courts. So your cyber dog, your cyber cat. You can't go and drop kick it across the front lawn for fun. You're not going to be able to do that. That cyborg pet has rights. So if you do that, you're going to find yourself, you will not only be charged, but you will be brigaded by the robot animal, cyborg animal rights organizations. They will come and they will demonstrate on your front lawn if you're exposed on social media of doing such behavior. And you think it's going to end there. It's not going to end there. That the people showing up to protest will also be robots as well, right? So that's coming too. So just think about it. You got to think ahead, folks. You got to think this stuff through. If you don't, if you don't think this through, you're going to be in for what Toffler called a future shock. You go check that book out. That was a trailblazer. Toffler's Future Shock. That was a groundbreaking book back in the 60s and 70s. I don't know when he wrote that. Might have been the 50s, way ahead of his time. But anyway, we're in for a future shock, folks. It's just going to get weird from here on out. We'll try our best, though, to keep it real. Let's take a break here with TNT, Today's News Talk, and we'll be right back. We'll be serious on the other side of this break, I promise. We're going to connect with Freddie Ponton. So stick around. We'll be right back.
TNT Radio's Rick Munn.
The election in Turkey, partly Twitter, they're saying this themselves, by the way. They said they were approached by the Turkish government last week, and they were told, they made it clear that Twitter was the only social media service not complying in full with existing court orders, and that they would be, they would be strangled if they didn't suppress some accounts and remove some tweets. So they did it. And I suppose, the arguments there, oh, well, they just complied. It was either that or get completely taken off for the entire country. So maybe they sacrificed a few people. Now you can get into the ins and outs of that as well. But one thing that's very important here to bear in mind, and this isn't about Twitter or Elon Musk or anybody else, but be under no illusion here. Even if you do get completely free and unrestricted speech, no suppression or shadow banning with algorithms on Twitter, and Elon Musk delivers all of that, the rules that are being brought in by Ofcom, for example, will say, okay, Elon, you can give all your users freedom of speech and freedom of reach and whatever, but if we are regulating you as a platform in the United Kingdom, for example, and you mess us around, we can pull the plug on your platform.
Rick Munn is locked and loaded on Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
This is a message for the parents of young children in the United States. I am Dr. Tess Lorry from the World Council for Health. Please consider the danger of vaccinating your children and babies with the COVID-19 injections. They are not the same as traditional vaccines and are causing significant harm to children around the world. Your children have their whole lives ahead of them. They are not endangered by COVID at all. Please hear us when we say, for your children, it is much safer to wait. Thank you.
Patrick Henningsen talks on Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, folks, welcome back. Welcome back. We're in hour number two of this live broadcast. And it's all fun and games, as the old saying goes, it's all fun and games until someone blows up a major pipeline. And that's exactly what happened this last year, September of 2022, 26th of September, to be more accurate, a day that will live in infamy, to borrow a very famous saying from Franklin Delano Roosevelt on December 7th, 1941, when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. That was definitely a turning point. That was officially the American entrance into the Second World War, and the rest is history. Pacific Front ended with the A-bombs, and they're still there occupying Okinawa and the DMZ in Korea. But over in Europe, it's a slightly different story because, you see, something's happened, a major attack, arguably probably the biggest attack on Western European infrastructure, really, since the Second World War, and nobody's taking credit for it. It's, well, we don't know who did it. Maybe it's the Russians first, and then it was after that. It was, well, it's a rogue Ukrainian cell, and, you know, they've got these various stories. So one of these fake stories, which has been drifted out by the Germans and New York Times, they've rehashed it again. They've revitalized this new Nord Stream conspiracy theory about the Andromeda yacht. And to help debunk this, but also just to give some clarity on what we think that they're distracting from by pushing out this type of a very strange and not very well developed conspiracy theory by the establishment. Why are they running this interference right now? We'll bring on our European correspondent, independent journalist, Freddie Ponton, joining us on the live link right now. Freddie, how you doing?
I'm very good, Patrick, and good to be on the show.
It's great to have you as well. I was pretty surprised to see they're still pushing this story, like they've kind of revitalized it. They've released a photo of this, I guess, a Ukrainian soldier is wearing camo there. Looks like a pizza chef who's doing, you know, soldiering on the weekends sort of thing. It's not, and the rumor is they say he might have been a scuba enthusiast. Okay. So they're saying that, and then have you had a look at this latest release on this story, Freddie?
I had indeed, Patrick. As you know, I'm investigating this Nord Stream attack. So it's obviously not of a great interest, because obviously when you acquire enough knowledge and understanding on what it takes to actually carry out a covert operation to take out this pipeline, not only one, but three explosions, you know, so different side, different dive, different technology. And then suddenly 2 months ago, we have the Spiegel talking about the divers, you know, using a chartered yacht to sabotage the Nord Stream pipelines. That of course got my attention, you know, with a little smirk on the side of my mouth. But really, it's really incredible how they're trying to build upon this Andromeda story found in Christiansos Island, which is rather close to the site of the blast. But really, experts are starting really endorse them. I don't like to call experts. Nobody's expert in that. It's unprecedented in Europe. But at least looking at people that are looking at it from a realistic point of view, are really, you know, asking the right questions. And perhaps one of the major questions that suddenly makes this whole story, you know, very shaky is the fact that if you're going to take divers at 75 meters deep, 80, even perhaps even further down, you're going to need to bring these people back to the surface. And if they spend, you know, enough time under the water, which this kind of job would have required, clearly you're going to need to have recompression chambers or hyperbaric facilities on the ship. You know, they can't just bring these people back to the surface and that's it. Let's go to the next holiday spot, you know. So that in itself already, it's just the whole story is prohibitive on that basis. So what we want to see, you know, if we are to be fair play, is a complete lab analysis of these so-called explosive traces. And today, with the technology available in defense lab, they will be very quickly able to decipher the origins of these explosives. So unless we have that, there is no need to talk further about the Andromeda, apart from a funny story.
I mean, honestly, I heard, you remember when this story was first drifted out, and then Seymour Hersh said, this is a fake story. It's designed to distract from my story, which he put out, the first article he put out in February on Substack on February 8th. And then, so when we saw it, they talked about a yacht, this Andromeda yacht that was chartered out of Poland. And apparently this was used for the Nord Stream bombing. And then, so they hadn't shown a picture of the yacht. So I immediately in my mind, Freddie, I had a picture in my head. I said, okay, let's give them, I'll run with this story. So I'm thinking, what have they got? Have they got a princess, yacht, you know, I was thinking 75 footer with a water level diving platform on the back, maybe a winch and a mini crane like they have, maybe a, you know, the tech bridge with the nav radar and all that. I thought, okay, if it's that, we can at least play along with this. But then I saw the picture of this Andromeda yacht yesterday, and it's a freaking 50-foot sailboat. Are they having a laugh?
They're having a laugh, right? It's really just the whole story, you know. It's that boat is registered, is home marina is in Rostock, you know, in Poland, and then it goes up to on the 6th of September, I think it goes to the German island of Rügen. And then he finally ends up somehow on the Danish island of Kristiansand. So I don't really understand how this even fits into the blast of the 26th of September. So how did that happen? They went there on the 6th of September, then they moved to the Bornholm island off the coast there. They spent 72 days, you know, sending divers up and down, placing, you know, according to the data, you know, 500 kilos, half a ton of explosive, three different sites, 75, you know, meters depth, and all that on board of that little shaky boat, no cranes, no nothing. I mean, this, how can even think this is acceptable? I mean, anybody that has looked into it a little bit, you know, doesn't have to spend like we do, you know, days and days onward, you know, looking into details and speaking to people, but at least just the basic, very quickly you will assess by yourself that this is a complete distraction, and this is no teeth. Yeah? It has no teeth whatsoever at all, Patrick. So I don't want to dedicate more time in talking about this boat anyway, because literally this will insult all the work that I've done, you know, towards this Nord Stream sabotage or attack. And I think you will see clearly in the upcoming report, the part three of Nord Stream sabotage, how much evidence and circumstantial evidence we were able to gather. That really clearly shows how difficult and how challenging these dives were. So, as I said, the distraction is something that is used by intelligence services around the world, not only in the United States, in Germany, in UK and France, and they will use any kind of little story to get you off track, you know. But we're not getting fooled by that, not one second, Patrick.
So just to, you know, educate the listeners, and there's some people probably listening that didn't hear maybe your previous segments or need a little refresher. You know, when we're talking about an operation like this, just kind of give us the general sketch of, you know, what's actually required to carry out that type of a sabotage operation. It's not something where you could just, you know, pull up in a boat and have some guys with some oxygen tanks and maybe, you know, a few packs of C4 and some flippers, and then just like, you know, park over the area and they jump off the side, and then they might go down there for a few hours and then they'll swim to the surface. Like, that's what this mainstream conspiracy is saying. What exactly is required, just a bit, without giving up any details of the current investigation that you're working on? I know it's sensitive stuff, but, you know, what you published before based on that, and just general, just your general description of what's involved in an operation like this.
Well, the good news, Patrick, is we don't have to make any assumptions, because we've had the ability, and we still today, although it's becoming more and more difficult because they're retrieving and they are basically purging the internet with any kind of information. And I can see the information disappearing every day. But what we have is previous training exercises that are similar to the Baltops 22 exercise, the one that took place the early part of from the 5th to the 17th of June 2022, where it is clearly the event which was used as a backdrop for planting these charges at the bottom of the Baltic Sea. So in order to understand what these guys are doing and how they do it, you need to look at previous exercises. You need to look at all these teams of divers, not especially SEALs divers, you know. Doesn't have to be a SEALs diver necessarily. But what we need to look at is what kind of divers will be most appropriate for this kind of job. And then the second part of it is you get to look at the logistics that is associated with putting together a covered operation in the middle of a training exercise. That includes, obviously, a lot of intelligence gathering. It involves pre-deployment teams to make sure that you control the environment in which you're going to insert, basically, divers, Navy divers on site and multiple sites as well. So the control of the environment is very important. Knowledge and obviously the ability to secure as well the environment. So it takes a lot of skills. A lot of equipment as well, like unmanned underwater vehicles that can scatter the area, that can provide live data to the main command post, that can basically tell us what's going on at the bottom of the sea. You know, so you just don't insert people like this out of the blue. You're going to try to put all the chances on your side, knowing that the Russians are watching. There's so many reports out there, you know, talking about Russians looking at exercises conducted by NATO, whether it's in the Northern Sea, whether it's in Norway, whether it's in the Baltics. The Russians have eyes everywhere and they're looking at it, and they have great technology from space to do so. So they don't really need to be present on the spot. They know if they're going to send delegations, you know, which was offered during Cold Response 2022, for example. The Russian refused. They say, we don't need to go there. We know what's going on. So they don't need that. So again, as I say, as long as you get the right divers, whether they're from the salvage unit, whether they come from explosive ordnance squadrons, whether they come from more like UCT teams, you know, experts in construction and demolitions, then it's you know, you're starting to realize that it takes really specific skills, people that are used to work together and that understand what it takes to pull off a covered operation at, you know, 75 meters below the surface. So you're going to need the right ships as well, you know, the amphibious, those that have a well, those that have basically the entire setup to allow basically a stealth operation or as stealth as possible operation. You're going to need a lot of things, you know, and a lot of teams working together. And while maintaining the other in the dark, you know, not everybody was in the know, only those that were selected to perform this job. And in part three, we'll talk about these really particular ships, crews, and team diving teams that were involved in the sabotage. I think today I've identified them, we'll feel comfortable that with the help of data crunchers, whether it's airplanes or whether it's naval traffic in the Baltic Sea, now we've narrowed it down. So I think it's going to be really focusing all these data research onto these particular ships as well. So as I say, it's a complete organization, and you need a very central command post with technology that provide basically a complete 3D view of the underwater environment. These technologies are known as C5, C6, ICR technology. These are basically technology on board of very few ships, those that are meant to act as command post for very specific missions, and we've identified that as well. So when you see all this amount of technology, logistic skills put together, and then you're offered a story with the Andromeda, you're starting to be like, hang on, come on, you know, this cannot be happening.
Yeah, it's fantasy. It's just pure fantasy.
It is fantasy, absolutely.
So you got, you know, just, you got the reconnaissance component, right? You got the reconnaissance component, and that's a big operation that's going to involve surveying, positioning, logistics, 3D imaging, locating the target. You've got that aspect of it. You said the teams, you said the ships, then you've got the technology on the ships as well. That needs to be a certain type of, you know, list of equipment and technical specifications. You've got the mini subs, likely you'd need, because Freddie, you kind of said this as well before, but this isn't a couple hours job, is it? This could actually be a multiple day job, right?
Well, I think that we saw that the missions changed. You know, it was clear that perhaps from the beginning, it was about, at the end of Battle Tops 22, to have these charges to go off, you know. But as we understand, and according, again, you know, we're taking this on the face value, but according to the Semmelhirsch report, you know, we need to take into consideration that the plan changed at the last minute almost, and they decided to trigger these charges at a later stage, which is far more remote from the Baltop exercise, you know, to avoid people making the correlation between the both events. So as I said to you, you know, what's very important in this job, it's really the ability to not only direct, but to coordinate and control all the assets that were necessary to accomplish these missions. And as I said, the battlefield situation in this case was a NATO naval exercise, gathering a lot of skills, you know, especially a lot of underwater technology, especially a lot of UUV, you know, unmanned underwater technology that has great independence. They are really capable of gathering that knowledge. It's a lot of reconnaissance, a lot of pre-deployment, a lot of knowledge and data gathering with the help of the local partners. You know, you get Danish, you get Norway. All these guys are very familiar. The Swedes are very familiar with this area. They can move a submarine without looking at the map. I mean, they know exactly what the Baltic is all about, where you can be seen, where you can hide, and so on and so forth. So, as I say, this was a NATO ally exercise, and we can clearly see how a team from the US, the UK could have plugged in into that local knowledge and basically perform the sabotage, you know, with all the technology available to them. And that is very important as well. We'll dig a little bit deeper in part three as far as the technology concerns. Very interesting.
So, and just to add to that, and obviously reiterate what you're saying, Freddie, is that, you know, if it's a 24-hour operation even, or multiple-day operation, you need to secure the area. Like, you need to secure the perimeter. And that means that the only way to really do this efficiently is to have it coincide with a major NATO military drill, like Baltops 22. It's one of the only operations, opportunities that you can actually do that. It makes perfect sense that would be the case.
Yes, it does. And if you remember, last time I asked the question to the deputy ambassador, Russian representative to the United Nations, Dmitry, I asked him the questions, and he straight away said, of course we were suspicious. So there's no way a huge amount of activities, naval and, you know, whether it's surface and underwater activities going to take place with the threat that we were privy to, you know, whether from Biden, from the British administrations and so on. It's absolutely certain, 100%, that the Russians were suspicious that they will use the Baltops 2022 as perhaps a backdrop to conduct a covert operation. And I think we, from the data we're starting that Russia wanted to go to the site, you know, to look and investigate, because I think they definitely kind of knew that something was going on. I mean, we can see that from the data, and when we look at the big pictures, we can see that there is already enough information out there to be very suspicious. So I can only imagine what today the Russians have actually on the actual operation. So again, you know, the blame on Russia and those, you know, Danish or Swedish press, you know, emphasizing on the presence of Russian, you know, near the site of the explosion. Of course, they would want to be there. They would want to be there, especially when you get intelligence that has been disseminated, you know, to different government, warning them about possible attack on key infrastructures like the Nord Stream pipelines. Of course, they're going to want to be there and protect the assets. So, as I said, this is very, very, very strange. And to pull that off, it will have required, they would have to make the life of the Russian Navy very difficult for them to access the site during that period. So they couldn't do it over 5 days and multiple dive. You know, this had to be done in a day, maybe a day and a half. But I would say the entire operation was done in a day. There's no doubt about it. Perhaps 6-10 hours. There was a lot of technology involved that allowed them to do it very quickly. and allowing them basically extracted, you know, extracted from the site. And that is the reason why in part two, we talked even further about this, what we call this submarine rescue systems that allows the extractions of divers from shallow water, 75, 80 meters. You can extract people and put them in hyperbaric chambers, recompression chambers, and off you go. You're off the sites, you know.
So would you say, from a mission a point of view, it's logical that if you have a shorter mission, you will need multiple teams to carry out a complicated mission in a short space of time? You would need multiple teams working together, as opposed to if you spread it out piece by piece over a period of days, you could compartmentalize the mission into units and have things done by different people over a longer time frame. So if it's done in a shorter time frame, you would have multiple teams working simultaneously. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. You see, as I say to you, you know, if you work from an amphibious group, for example, at the Kearsarge RGMU group, for instance, you know, these are very interesting informations, because you can see what they're composed of, what kind of ships that are integrated in the amphibious kind of group. And then from that, you can look at their previous experience, the teams that they actually take on board, you know, the diving team, the EOD team, the UCT team, the CBs, all these different skills are available, and they boarded these ships. And then on the other side, you got something like the USS Mount Whitney that provide a complete, you know, post of command, where commanders can literally come on board and logging into the systems. They are all, most of them, trained on at least C4 ISR system, which allow them to, as I said, to direct and coordinate and control their assets. They're part of the responsibility for the missions. So, as I said, it's very important to understand what's going on the surface, but also subsurface at the bottom of the sea. And to control that, you're going to need technology, UUV technology, radar sensors, and much more. There's many more technology and a kind of a mapping of the entire environment using different technology. So that's very interesting, because this was a great exercise, if you will. The bad part is the sabotage, but the exercise on itself has been very interesting, because it really requires all set of skills and coordination in order for that to happen in a short amount of time and very efficiently, if you will.
No, indeed. I think we're starting to get a clearer picture, Freddie, here of really what's involved, and it's not trivial. This is not a fly-by-night operation, a drive-by, as they call it. It's not a drive-by op. This is a seriously complicated op, and it needs a certain list of conditions and equipment and people and facilities and intelligence and support and all. It's a specific list to even make this possible to begin with. And so what you've done here brilliantly, Freddie, is you've done this shopping list here. You've assembled this shopping list, and we're getting a clear picture of what's really involved. And it just rubbishes these alternative distraction stories that they keep drifting out in order to get people to look away, basically, and get obsessed with other minutiae that have nothing to do, really, in the end of the day, with this at all. But look, we're going to take a break. I'm with Freddie Ponton, an independent journalist, investigative journalist. We're talking about the Nord Stream. On the other side, we're going to get a little bit of a update on the situation in Ukraine. Things are getting interesting. We'll definitely want to hear Freddie's thoughts on that as well. All this and more on the other side. I'm Patrick Henningsen. We'll be right back.
With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
Come on, FBI. You're going to have to do a lot better than that if you want us to buy one of your Nazi false flags. I know we call you the Phoebes, and yes, that does stand for feeble, but that doesn't mean that every single thing you do has to be feeble. Seriously, a little effort go a long way. I'm referring, of course, to the latest absurd story about 19-year-old Sai Varshith Kandula, an Indian from Missouri who allegedly rented a U-Haul box truck, and drove it empty at a low rate of speed into a barricade at the White House, and conveniently had a Nazi flag on the seat next to him, all ready for FBI to spread out on the ground in front of the accident scene for one of their patented photo ops, just like they took empty file folders marked classified and top secret and spread them on the floor at Mar-a-Lago to create the impression that Donald Trump was carelessly strewing about classified documents, which was a completely false narrative. This one is too. Just ask any 19-year-old college student who has tried to rent a U-Haul truck to move to or from college. Can't be done. So who rented the vehicle, when, and what's the story here? Because one thing is guaranteed. It's not what the Phoebes are telling us. From MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
Every time you hop on your motorbike, who else is coming with you? Well, there's your girlfriend.
Hey, babe.
Your mum.
Hi, love.
Your dad.
Hey, shuffle closer, will you?
Your mates.
Hey, buddy.
How you going?
Well, there we go.
Not to mention your dreams, your plans, and your future. So next time you're on your motorbike, ride safely. Because there's a lot riding on it. A message brought to you by the Government of South Australia.
Political commentator and investigative journalist. You're with Patrick Henningsen on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to TNT, today's News Talk. This is the Patrick Henningsen Show. We find ourselves in the final hour of the show, and this is the final segment. We're in the final stretch here on Wednesday. Very interesting how things are developing in the Ukraine. A lot of people might not be aware, but the sort of commander-in-chief of their armed forces, his name is Zaluhny, and he went missing at the beginning of May, and nobody knew where he went, and it was like, where did he go? This is the head of the Ukrainian armed forces. This is the top general, disappeared. And there are theories that he was in Cyprus, larging it up after padding his bank account. He was on a yacht heading from Bimini. I mean, there's all sorts of theories going on. But we found out in the last 48 hours, and I saw this reported on Russian Telegram late last week, that he actually was on one of the front lines and may have been killed in action. Okay, so finally, here we are, May 23rd, May 24th. And they've confirmed, now a spokesperson for the regime in Kiev have said the commander-in-chief of the armed forces of Ukraine, Zaluhny, suffered a head injury and shrapnel wounds as a result of Russian missile attack on a command post near Kherson back in early May. So, I mean, the fact that this was kept under wraps for so long, this is not a good look. This is not, what does this tell us? This is confusion, mixed messages, who's in charge. So he underwent a craniotomy, this is like skull surgery after being wounded. So this is serious. According to the doctors, the military boss will live, but he will no longer be able to do his job, say sources within the Zelensky regime. So meanwhile, while this is happening, where's Zelensky? Bakhmut's fallen. Zaluhny is out of, you know, could be a vegetable for the rest of his life. No one knows who's in charge of the Ukrainian military. They're not going to their NATO meetings. He missed that NATO meeting. So Zelensky's off jetting around with the Justice League of superheroes at the G7 in Hiroshima, Japan. And before that, he was in the Arab League, like, basically chastising all the Arab leaders that they were too friendly with Russia. Like this guy. So the country's falling apart. His military's getting hammered. A chief commanding general. They hid him away for a month. Freddie, this doesn't look good.
Yes, that's the least you can say about it. You know, I think that, you know, the technocrats are really kind of awakening to the fact that a war is not win on a chart, you know, but on a and a good understanding of your enemy's capabilities and knowledge of the ground and much more, as you can imagine. I mean, I couldn't put it better than a colonel that I was listening to a few days ago. And he said, if you were to look at Russia as a boxer, then you will see that since they entered the ring, they've only used their jab. And that's really a good metaphor to describe how powerful the Russian armed forces and the Wagner group has been, just basically just that, without really deploying full capacity, being able to contain, repel, and advance, you know, in Ukraine. So the reality of the ground is catching up. And clearly, I think everybody knows today that this is not the Ukrainian armed forces that really are calling the shots. You know, these are really U.S. NATO-led operations. And most of these commanders have been trained by the U.S. and the NATO-allied member state forces. So they follow basically the lead. So for these guys to be taken out, it's relevant and it's irrelevant at the same time. But really what's really matter is what's coming next, because obviously the major debate about is about this reconquering Bakhmut. It's about the counter offensive and how this is going to be done. Technically speaking, from a military point of view, is it still possible? Does Ukraine still has the armed forces or enough armed forces to do the job on the ground and so on? So what we're seeing and what you've described earlier was Zelensky going around different platforms, basically trying to do the job which he's been paid for, which is to ask where he's not asking. He's been asked to ask basically these platforms for support, for money, for technology, and for long-term commitments. So this is not a Zelensky initiative. You know, this is not Zelensky coming to an international platform and speaking for himself, for his countries. He's been groomed, he's been prepped, and he's delivering the message that he's expected to deliver. And the result of that, Patrick, is, for instance, yesterday, the French Foreign Ministry confirmed that France is prepared to enter into an agreement with Ukraine to provide Zelensky and future Ukrainian administration with security guarantees. So we're really talking about France, talking about a long-term agreement here with Ukraine. So it's definitely important to understand the context behind these kind of statements and what triggered it, you know. So that's what perhaps I'd like to discuss today with you, Patrick.
Yeah, so France security guarantees with Ukraine. And the thing that strange about this, Freddie, is that this is not being done through NATO. This is a direct move by the head of state in France from the French Republic directly to Ukraine, offering this security guarantee. It almost looks like a bilateral kind of agreement. So I'm like, what's going on here? Is this, what does this signify? It's not from NATO HQ, it's Macron and Zelensky. What do you make of this?
Well, it's like any story, you know, you obviously need to look, to scratch a little bit the varnish and trying to see exactly where this all statement originated from. So I looked into it and very quickly I realized that it was actually part of a much broader move where France, Germany and the United Kingdom have all agreed to play the role of guarantor of security for Ukraine. So if you will, Patrick, this statement was actually first a response to an article that was published by the Washington Post on May the 22nd, which indicated that NATO countries are considering an Israeli-style security agreement, from what I can draw from the article. And this is an Israeli-style security agreement for Ukraine. As we all know, Ukraine membership to NATO is not being entertained, at least not in the short term. Despite the fact that, you know, Jens Stoltenberg, the NATO Secretary General, is constantly reminding the world that he's his intention is to grant Ukraine with a NATO membership. So already you can see that there's a much broader context to this story. And what's really interesting from this Washington Post article is that we understand that on the 21st of May, President Volodymyr Zelensky had accepted a personal invitation from NATO Secretary Stoltenberg, and that was to attend an upcoming NATO summit, which is due to take place in the city of Vilnius in Lithuania, and that's going to take place in July this year. So we wanted, obviously, to understand a little bit better the context of this meeting and what was the purpose of this forum, if you will. And what we've discovered is that the program behind this forum in Lithuania is for the Western allies to launch a new foreign policy platform, which they've already named the Ukraine NATO Council. So that's very, very interesting indeed. And that is taking us, obviously, to a new level whereby we have an intermediary platform in between NATO membership platform, EU platform, and all these individual countries, as you mentioned, France, but also Germany and England, being able to use this council as a policy apparatus to conduct their little scam, if you will.
Wow! Wow! So let me throw this curveball at you here. The other members of Europe are saying there's no way that Ukraine's going to be a member of NATO, not anytime soon, maybe never. What about this? What about if what's left of Ukraine is joined or absorbed by a NATO member state? I'm thinking of Poland here. Okay. Now I know that sounds like a radical move, but Poland has passed legislation to normalize the laws between the two countries and to give Ukrainians equal rights to Polish citizens, etc. So like a reciprocal, you know, legal recognition and all of this stuff. And so it just seems like that would be, there might be some kind of a surprise move as part of some kind of negotiations of a ceasefire, you know, at the end of the war. When they start, you know, the Europeans like to draw borders after major wars, redraw borders. Do you think there's a possibility this could happen? Not now, but, you know, in a couple of years?
Well, I believe there is a strong possibility that the map will have to be redesigned. That's for sure. It doesn't matter which way, you know, whether it's going to benefit Russia or Ukraine or Poland. But there will definitely be a time for the world map to be reshaped around this part of the world. And Poland will have to play definitely a role in that. How this is going to fit, it's all speculation, Patrick, at this stage. But we can see where this is going, you know. And we know that this NATO membership in Ukraine cannot see the day because it will very, very quickly be interpreted by Russia as a provocation, almost a declaration of war, if you will. So today, there's still, you know, clear that NATO's allies and the United States are at war with Russia, but it's still kind of in the air. It's not pronounced. It's not, you know, it's all in disguise, if you will. But it's quite clear what the intents are. But now to go and give a NATO membership, and I think Putin and the Russian administration as a whole has clearly, expressed their position as far as their move and their reaction should Ukraine be granted a NATO membership. So there's no doubt about that. This is not a road that NATO and the US can entertain unless they are 100% ready to commit to a full-wage war, which will implicate, obviously, the ties between China and Russia as well. So there's, as I said, this is a far more global implication than just Russia and Ukraine.
No, without a doubt, Israeli-style defense agreement, that's basically, you know, permanent arms and money transfer every year, forever and ever and ever. That's interesting and disturbing at the same time. And then lastly, just got 30 seconds left. What about the election cycles in these countries like the U.S.? How much of a bearing is that going to have on this?
Well, it's basically accelerating the clock, you see, because obviously the the candidates for the presidency and for this presidential election in 2024 are clearly not in favor of a war with Russia. I think they are more interested in finding solutions to bring back peace to the world and maintain some form of equilibrium for the balance of power between the South, but also in between the East and the West. So the world is reshaping itself. Europe is reshaping itself. And what's going to make the decision where this is going, it's going to be literally in the hand of the next president of the United States. It will be interesting to see how Donald Trump is going to perform and how RFK is going to perform. And all these two guys will be able to find a common ground to work together.
And also Ron DeSantis is announcing tonight, that'll be on Twitter Spaces with Elon Musk. That'll be 11 p.m. UK time, 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We'll probably listen to that. We'll also run a Twitter Space as well, 21 Wire Forum, which is going to start at 8:30 UK time on Twitter. Just follow me at 21 Wire. We're going to do Bilderberg. We have co-correspondents from Bilderberg on the ground to give us insight of what happened this year and more and much, much more. Freddie Ponton, amazing. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
And also thank you to Phil Zimmerman for that very strange segment in the first hour, and very entertaining as well. I'm Patrick Henningsen. Listen, you guys, it's been real. It's been amazing. I'm signing out now, but stay on the network. We'll be right back.